Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the History of England, episode 404, A New Model Coup. Now then everyone, I believe in being upfront, honest, forthright with you all. We have been together a long time, you and I, and I reckon I owe it to you not to coat the bitter pill of history with sugar. So, here it is, not going to lie to you, it's getting complicated. There are lots of moving parts. Let me try and give you a super summary of the big players. So, in the blue corner is the new model army, who know what they fought for and love what they know, deeply hurt at their growing unpopularity, deeply worried at the efforts of the Presbyterian Parliament to discard them, throw them away into the dustbin of history. In the Kedrawner, in the red corner, we have Denzel and Co., determined to free the people from the burden of war, to establish a national godly church fit for the coming of the saints. In the green corner, we have the Levellers with their vision of a new world ruled by the people, for the good of the people, in a world of religious toleration and hope. In the last corner, which from here seems to sort of look off-white, no, taupe, that's it, taupe, with a rather daring paisley pattern, is Charles, King of England, seized by the army and in their control, watching, waiting, delaying, probing, giving nothing away, seeking to exploit the divisions and factions to divide, to re-establish the ancient constitution of king, lords and commons and the glorious Anglican Church for the good of all people. We've heard how the new model's essential unity of experience and purpose has allowed it to become extraordinarily open, subject to a general council now, including the agitators or agents of the ordinary soldiers, sitting at the very same table as the generals and senior officers, and which, in response to the hostility of Hollis and Co. and the Parliament, under the creeping influence of the Levellers, has challenged Parliament to satisfy its grievances and put together a remarkably generous and liberal peace proposal to the King, the heads of proposals. And it seemed the evident power of the army had at last forced Parliament to back down to accept army demands for their grievances. Hollis and the 11 members had fled the Commons. Here then was the moment. Everything was in place. Fairfax and the King could lead the army back to England. England would be reborn with a more equitable balance between King, Lords and Commons and wider religious toleration under the proposals of the heads of proposals. And then this vision came crashing down. Charles contemptuously rejected the generous heads of proposals, yet again chasing castles in the air. An army from Scotland, a cheap deal with Hollis. An army from Ireland, furry purple lizards from the Oort cloud. Anything. In London, the counter-revolution surged. Hordes of angry, rootless, demobbed soldiers, the Reformados, rioted, stormed Parliament, whipped on by the London Common Council and Presbyterian MPs. The Mayor tried to call out the militia to fight the new model. Hollis and the 11 members reappeared in Parliament and took control. The Speaker and many MPs fled for safety to the army. Chaos and opposition had returned instead of hope, light and justice. Well then, in the next period, I hope that didn't sugarcoat it too much, in the next period to 1648, we are going to hear then of a kiletry moo, a military coup, of a maelstrom of debate about the nature of the English constitution, of radical democratic ideas driven by a revolutionary army rank and file, a military elite willing to consider fundamental change and the power of the radical populism of the Levellers. For the moment, though, Fairfax, the Army Council and independent MPs determined to face down the counter-revolutionary surge in London. A leading figure among them was the Speaker of the House, William Lentil. Now look, we haven't heard of Lentil since the arrest of the five members all those many years ago. And he was no unsullied hero, I have to tell you, if there are such a thing. His reputation suffered, actually, from a bout of trashing by Clarendon after the Restoration. Rather unfairly, in a way, but there are rather too many accusations of dodgy business dealing and manipulating a parliamentary process to ignore what Clarendon writes. Nonetheless, the lad does have his moments, as he proved in front of Charles all those years ago, and as he proves now, in August 1647. So, as the reformados had stormed and coerced Parliament, he had issued a public declaration in London on the 31st of July 1647. He protested in the strongest possible terms that votes in the Commons had been forced by threats of violence. He declared this had made them void. In protest against the continuing violence, he declared it was time to withdraw when the crowd jostle, pull and hail the Speaker all the way down to his coach. And so it was Lentor that led MPs like Arthur Hazelrigg and Edmund Ludlow out of Parliament, out of London, and up to the army camp at Hounslow. For Fairfax and the council, this was critical because it meant that now, despite the absence of the King, who they'd really hoped to have with them when they went into London, now they could return to London, claiming they were re-establishing the freedom of Parliament because they had Lentor and the MPs with them. And so, this is what they did. On the 6th of August, Fairfax drew up 15,000 of the New Model Army at Hounslow Heath to the west of London, nestling in the flight path of the Heathrow Airport. More MPs had kept coming in protest against the violence, and they now had a contingent of about 100 MPs and 14 peers with them. So off they set towards London, with the soldiers throwing their hats in the air and shouting, "Lords, Commons and a free Parliament!" Now, they might well have been worried about what they'd meet. Would the famous lines of communication built with such community and revolutionary fervour in 1643, would they be manned against them? Would they need to storm and bombard and batter against the walls? But if they were so worrying, they needn't have. Because support for the counter-revolution was a knock-kneed sort of thing, perfectly designed to have sand kicked in its face with impunity. And in fact, Fairfax had been receiving letters of support from all over southern England. The Hackney and Southwark trained bands were refusing to cooperate with the mayor, and on the 2nd of August, a crowd had gathered at the Guildhall and persuaded the Common Council to write a letter to Fairfax, offering him their trembling submission and all the beach towels his heart could desire. At a time which can be confidently described as the wee hours, 2 o'clock in the morning, some advance contingents of the New Model approached the London gates at Southwark. They faced no fire from inside. And in fact, to their relief, the trained bands of Southwark opened up the gates in front of them and welcomed them in. This was a taste of what was to come next. The cavalry regiments of the army approached London from the west. At Hyde Park, they were greeted by the Lord Mayor and the Aldermen who'd spent the previous evening carefully knitting arse covers and preparing speeches of grovelling welcome. William Lentor, the MPs and peers, were ceremoniously restored to Parliament, and its first acts were to announce a day of national thanksgiving. Oh, and a month's pay for the army. The following day, all 15,000 of the New Model marched through London, wearing the laurels of victory in their hair. Cromwell rode at the head of the cavalry, and Fairfax, who'd been ill, was in his coach in the middle of the procession with his wife Anne and Cromwell's wife Elizabeth. 20 regiments marched through London, colours are flying, trumpets are playing, drums are beating, Hollis and Co. are leaping for cover. Down Cheapside they went, and then they spread out and separated, flowing through the streets, lined with cheering people, relieved to see order restored. Now look, that is not to say there were not many sullen Presbyterians skulking inside looking grumpy, but the point is that to most, the army actually was not unwelcome in this circumstance, and their legendary orderliness was applauded. One commentator remarked that all these thousands of soldiers stole not so much as an apple. Well, I guess you could look at this and declare it a military coup, or at least factional infight backed by the army, and you could well be right. This display of military might, however, did not end resistance. Denzel and Co. remained sitting in Parliament, which is really pretty hench of them. and to the fury of many in the army, they continued to try to manipulate business in the Commons, and they were doing a pretty good job. But this was not just Canute on the beach stuff. This is like Canute getting up from his throne, popping on his speedos or budgie smugglers, diving into the sea and swimming against the tide. They'd lost, and they really should have known it. Parliament declared Fairfax Constable of the Tower of London. I found that exciting. Any Kingmaker fans out there? Little known board game? Well, if there are any, you'd know that, failing a peasants' revolt that took the king to Ravenscar, the Constable of the Tower is always a winning position. Fairfax was a bit starstruck, actually. His very first act as constable was to go there and ask to see its copy of Magna Carta, and when it was reverentially brought out and laid in front of him, he said, probably glancing at the cameras as he said it, "This is what we have fought for, and by God's help, we must maintain." The Lords immediately passed a resolution declaring that Magna Carta was in fact merely a peace treaty, but then voted an ordinance voiding all legislation passed since the 26th of July, the Reformado riots, and the start of the counter-revolution. Still, Hollis and their faction in the Commons resisted. They voted the Lord's ordinance down. Ireton, Cromwell, Fairfax begged them to reconsider, pleaded with them, desperate not to be forced to lay violent hands on the Parliament for which they'd fought. But after 5 failed votes, in the end it was Cromwell who resolved it. He angrily complained to the Colonel and MP, Edmund Ludlow, that the 11 members will never leave until the army pulls them out by their ears. He ordered a regiment to plonk themselves meaningfully in Hyde Park, looking balefully at Westminster. And oh, the ordinance passed. Hollis and the 11 members took the hint and fled. Now look, Denzil, I have to say, was clearly a man who understood the turn of fortune's wheel and how these things go. Some months before, he'd sent his mum, eldest son, and 2,000 quid to Normandy, and that is where he went now. With a bit of time on his hands now, for the moment, he started to write his memoirs, of course, as you do, about how great he was and how rubbish everyone else had been. However, grieve not, gentle listeners, our Denzil will be back. Back by August 1648. Something to look forward to. Now that Parliament was brought to heel, the lines of communication were all dug up. Golly, the good citizens of London who built them with all that blood and sweat and tears must have been gutted. All that hard work, oh come on! But they and the new model gloomily got to work and they all got laid out. The Lord Mayor was then charged with treason and replaced. And then the London Common Council was asked to cough up all the multiple monthly assessments that it had not yet paid, more months unpaid than any other county in England. Wherein lay the root cause of all of this latest kerfuffle? If London had ponied up what it owed, maybe the soldiers would have been at home now and the levellers arrested and behind bars. It would have made history a lot duller, I have to tell you, but I imagine if you were trying to get on and making a living, dull history is what you are looking for. Whatever podcasters demand, no one wants to live in interesting times. But London did not so pony, and it is surely symbolic that it was the City of London where Mammon holds sway that refused to pay the ferryman of liberty. It would continue to refuse until the end of 1648. Well, there we go, a military coup, I suppose, though with the support of speakers and some MPs to gloss it. And for many, it has to be said, it was again another chance for a bright new start. Certainly it was for the radical lawyer John Cook, who as well as his legal work had also taken to writing pamphlets on social issues, arguing for the rights of the poor, for radical reform of the legal system to make it accessible to all and much, much cheaper. I think we've heard in these pages, eons ago, how he'd worked as a lawyer in Ireland, how despite his radical reforming views, he'd sent advice to Stratford as he faced trial, and he'd set up a legal practice in London. The year previously, he'd supported the lawyer John Bradshaw in pleading John Lilburn's case for freedom and compensation. So he now set pen to paper again, and he wrote a very optimistic piece once the army had arrived. A union of hearts, he called it, arguing that only the army could secure liberty of conscience and reform the courts of justice as the country needed. John Cook would continue to write on other issues that were shared by the Levellers, proposing better support and free medical services for the poor, for example. And so, the hopes for a better world flowered in the sun of free speech. Now, we're going to spend the rest of the episode walking through the sand dunes of the political ins and outs up to the end of October 1647, when we will arrive at the shoreline and lap up against the sea of the Putney debates, which will be the focus of the next episode with the help of the Crowther players and guests. Something to look forward to. But let's stick to the knitting and let's stick to this week first. So, we're going to hear more about Charles and his attitudes after all the satisfaction of sending Ireton and Rainsborough packing what with their silly, optimistic heads. So, as he came south towards London, first to Oatland's house and then back to his old stomping ground of Hampden Court, just like Pinocchio, he at last felt just like a real little king again. People gave to see him, and they were really pleased he was back. He was surrounded by reverence and love, and indeed his children. He was happily planning secret plans and clever tricks, writing to Hamilton and the Scots, to Ormond in Ireland, to hide on the continent, hoping for some of these boats to come in with their little fishes on little dishes. So, it seems sensible, if you agree, to just nip around the Three Kingdoms, just briefly, to see how things are going, and what that portended for Charles's fortunes. Okay? Scotland first, then. Now, the whispering of John Maitland, Earl of Lauderdale, in the Royal Lug had been one of the reasons why Charles had rejected the heads of proposals. So, maybe we should fly north over the hills to Scotland. As I have mentioned, the Duke of Hamilton had wearily resumed the mantle of royal service, and he'd returned to sit at the Scottish Governing Council of State, the Committee of Estates. Let us remember together why the Scottish Revolution had come about. Firstly, to defend the most perfect religion in the form of the Presbyterian Kirk of Scotland, and to then institute a political structure that ensured no king could roll back that perfect Christian society. Look, they revered the line of the Stuart kings, and the covenant itself swore the whole nation to support royal rights. Nonetheless, they had perceived that the greatest threat to Scotland's religious settlement came from this particular iteration of its own king and needed to be protected. But now, that story needed to be modified. Now, there was an even greater threat. Now, all agreed that the greatest threat to Scotland's security came from an England ruled by a sectarian, independent parliament, fervently opposed to the idea of imposing said perfect Kirk across all three kingdoms. Argyll agreed with that, even Hamilton agreed with that. What they disagreed was how to deal with the threat. So, if you were Argyll, and he had, after all, dominated the political scene since pretty much 1640, you put your faith in a Fortress Scotland. A Fortress Scotland defended by its peerless and endlessly successful army. You held a vague hope in the concept of a federated union with England, which had been the last strategy. You hoped that the English Presbyterians would win and help impose said perfect Kirk on the Three Kingdoms, but that hope was now receding, looked a little bit distant, so you needed a plan B. If you were a royalist covenanter, your hopes flowed towards the king. Rather than a Fortress Scotland, you wanted to engage with the king, do a deal on the best possible terms, while accepting that Charles would rather eat his own liver than swear to the covenant. Then once that was agreed, whatever deal he could get that Scottish army together, give them a good meal and a pep talk, send them to knock his enemies into a cocked hat in England, whatever a cocked hat is, and place the cocked crown back on his head, and crush those independents, crush them in the name of the Lord, I tell you, crush them. So, a disagreement about strategy, but to re-emphasise what everyone in Scotland agreed was that the worst of all possible words, the anti-Pangloss, was facing an England ruled by independence. We probably just need to refresh our understanding about attitudes in Scotland to monarchy, though. I just want to make it clear that at no point and in no place and at no time had anyone in Scotland proposed or even thought that Scotland without its Stuart king was a good thing or an attractive proposition. Whereas in England, the king competed with the common law and parliament in a way as the heart of the nation, in Scotland, there were no competitors to that. The Stuart were the embodiment of the people, an unbroken line of 300 years. Not even the Kirk could compete with that, although it came reasonably close. So the Scots had been genuinely shocked by the failure to reach an agreement with the king. They couldn't understand it. And they began to blame their political leaders, who, let us face it, if we're being honest now, were hardly the embodiment of compromise either. But they were at least a little more trustworthy and consistent than Charles. And so look, Hamilton's plan to engage with the king was gaining more and more ground against Argyll's Fortress Scotland approach. The argument now came down to revolve around the army. The army was commanded by David Leslie. David Leslie was Argyll's man, and there is no way he would allow it to invade England in support of the king's position there against the wishes of Argyll. So, there was frankly no point Hamilton, Lauderdale and the Royalist Covenanters reaching an engagement with the king, because there'd be no army to back it up. So, here's the Hamilton proposal. First of all, David Leslie's army must be disbanded. It was effectively propping up Argyll's regime. It must go, die, shuffle off the mortal coil, generally cease to be. Even it had to be nailed to its perch. Once that was done, of course an army was needed for the cocked hat thing, so a new army must be raised, banded under Hamilton. The excuse for doing that would be available once an agreement, an engagement, had been struck with Charles, and they could wave it triumphantly and declare peace in our time. Well, war in our time. Because then, with the king's engagement, they could invade England, give the new model the kick up the arse it so richly deserved, and delete the independence in the name of the National Presbyterian Church. Simple, straightforward, bish, bash, and indeed, bosh. Every soul would be saved. Well, the chosen ones, anyway. Now, for a while, there had been no question at all of deleting the Scottish army. That would have been daft. There was a royalist rebellion in the northeast near Aberdeen. There was Alistair MacCullagh in the Highlands. But once those had been dealt with, and after a spot of barn burning it had been, as we heard earlier, and MacCullagh had fled to Ireland, well, you know, who needs an army anymore? It cost a fortune into those things. Come on, let's put it to the vote. It is exactly that that happened on the 15th of October 1647, a vote in the Committee of Estates about whether or not to present David Leslie with his gold watch and a P-45. The vote was going to be very, very close. Argyll stood on the edge. His iron grip was no longer iron. It was a sort of polystyrene type thing. The vote was taken. There was just one vote in it. By one vote, Leslie Argyll survived. But Epirus would have known it was the kind of victory that preceded defeat. It was little more than a consolation prize. Argyll was fatally weakened. He could no longer command Scotland. Down at Hampton Court, the Scottish commissioners were quietly and grimly discussing terms with the king. And at last, they looked as though they might be prepared to compromise. OK, so that's the Scots. Interesting times, I think you'll agree. Now, I suggest that before we go back to England, we hop over the Irish Sea to the Emerald Isle and follow the fortunes of Alistair MacCullagh and see how things are going on there. OK?
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Let us follow MacCullagh to Ireland then, for there his talents were much sought after. Cardinal Rinuccini made ready to implement the new strategy to push the English and Scots into the sea. They were unable to start said pushing, however, before Ormond had handed over Dublin to a new governor, the parliamentarian Philip Sidney, Viscount Lisle, and the arrival of some fresh British troops. On his way out, Ormond is said to have remarked that he preferred English rebels to Irish ones. It is not recorded whether he slammed the door as he left. He would then have a bit of fun in London, and by March 1648, end up at the court of the Prince of Wales in exile. Incidentally, as a wee digression et, the Republican MP and wit Henry Martin, back in the Commons, made an extraordinarily rare intervention at this point with the appointment of Viscount Lisle. Martin abhorred the violence and devastation visited on the Irish from both sides and wanted Lisle's role not to be military but to be purely diplomatic. He likened those who wanted Ireland to be all Protestant to those as lie buried in Palestine, meaning doomed to bloody failure, like the failed attempts to recover the Holy Lands. He demanded that they should instead seek peace with the rebels, and he wrote, "If not to grant them almost any terms of peace, at least to hearken to their demands." If only more people had listened to the likes of Henry Martin A. Anyway, sadly, he was a pretty lone voice, and against this new influx of soldiers into Ireland, Rinuccini tried to bring the rebel forces of Ireland together to consolidate them, and he managed it to a degree. But good Lord, was there a lot of bickering. Owen Roe O'Neill and the other main commander, Preston, hated each other so. Also, the Confederacy was generally torn. For many Irish Catholics in Leinster and Munster, the prospect of domination by O'Neill's army of Ulster was almost worse than domination by the English Parliament. O'Neill's activities in Ulster of scorched earth tactics bled prestige from Rinuccini's leadership of the Confederacy, despite O'Neill's military success at Benburb. Nor was O'Neill University popular even in Ulster. When McCullough returned, Randall MacDonald, Earl of Antrim, refused to allow him to join O'Neill's army, and McCullough was instead sent south to fight in Munster. The Highlanders McCullough had brought back with him, the Redshanks, as they were called from the colour of their plaids, were instead sent to fight with the Confederate commander Preston in Leinster to pursue the absolutely essential component of expelling the English from Ireland, the capture of Dublin's fair city, where the cockles are so pretty, or however it goes. O'Neill and Preston had managed to combine their forces, thereby creating the largest Confederate army ever. But they hated each other so much they couldn't actually stay together and keep it going. Nonetheless, as Thomas Preston shadowed the parliamentary forces from Dublin, he had a substantial force of 8,000, including 1,000 cavalry. Now, he was shadowing a rather talented parliamentary commander, an Irishman of Welsh descent, Michael Jones. In August, Jones set out on a 32-mile charge to relieve one of the few fortresses left in Parliament's hands at Trim. Ah, thought Preston, he saw a gap in the wall, a chink in the armour, a breach. Maybe he could take Dublin before Jones realised what he was doing and returned to defend it. He went for it. He didn't get there. Instead, Jones intercepted him at a place called Dungan's Hill. Despite having a smaller force, Jones's generalship and his cavalry, it has to be said, were much better, and Preston, frankly, made a bit of a horlicks of the whole thing. As a result, the Confederate army was badly mauled, losing 3,000 troops. The Redshanks, interestingly, implemented their Highland charge tactics, which allowed them to escape into a bog where they couldn't be followed by cavalry, and so escaped. O'Neill at that point came south and prevented Jones's pursuit, thereby saving the remnants of Preston's army, but nonetheless, Dungan's Hill was a disaster for Rinuccini and the Confederate cause. Still, all was not yet lost. Let me now take you to the south-west of Ireland, to Munster, where Viscount Taaf commanded a major force of 7,000 for the Confederates. Now, he faced the parliamentary commander, an example of that very rare beast, a Gaelic Protestant lord, Murrough O'Brien. Murrough O'Brien had a brutal reputation. Murrough the Burner, he became known after an atrocity in Cashel. Styled Earl of Inchiquin, I believe he traces his descent all the way back to Brian Boru of the 11th century, which is quite an ancestry. He'd fought until 1644 with the Royalist Confederates, but that had been a tricky relationship. Trust between Catholic and Protestant factions was never good, and so in 1644, Inchiquin had jumped ship to Parliament. He hated the independents with passion, but dependence on supplies from England kept him on board for the moment anyway. Anyway, so there we are, not far from Cork, when Taaffe and Inchiquin's armies met at Knocknonnes in November 1647. Taaffe again had the larger numbers, and also had at their side Alastair MacCulloch, commanding the right wing with the remnants of his Ulstermen hardened by the Scottish campaign. And MacCulloch's command proved true. The Highland charge again worked its magic, and Inchiquin's left wing was routed, chased from the field. Flushed with the victory, MacCulloch and his men set to reaping the fruits of victory from the baggage train, of course, as you do. Sadly, the celebrations were therefore premature. While he pillaged the pillows, Inchiquin's cavalry were putting the rest of Taaffe's army to the sword. Once that had been achieved, they then turned their attention back to MacCulloch. Surrounded, Alastair MacCulloch and his men were slaughtered, and MacCulloch passed into song and legend, and sadly out of our story. The two defeats at Dungan's Hill and Knocknonnes knocked the stuffing out of Rinuccini's strategy to expel the English from Ireland. It didn't leave much stuffing left in the teddy bear of his mastery of the Confederate Association either. At the next meeting of the General Assembly of the Confederate, there was Rinuccini stuffing strewn all over the floor as though a dog had got hold of the bear and had a high old time. In the end, Rinuccini survived and a new strategy was devised. Correspondingly, delegates were sent to the Queen's Royal Court in Exile in Paris and to the Pope in Rome. They went to offer the government of Ireland to the Prince of Wales under a sort of papal protectorate. Few of the Old English relished this idea. Few of the Old English relished the idea that all Confederate forces would be in control of O'Neill. So, Dublin was safe. Rinuccini's plan had failed. Munro's army of New Scots, though much depleted, remained in Ulster. O'Neill's army did what they could to survive, and Charles could expect little help from Ireland. OK, so that's the little tour done. Back to Blighty now, where the story during August and September is really about attitudes in the army. Just to hit you now with a memory of a few golden oldies. When I was but an tiny boy, a hey ho and a wind and a rain, or however it goes, there was a song that Terry Wogan used to play on Radio 2 as we drove on our way to school. I suspect I am losing a pretty fair proportion of you, but stick with me. Look, it was a song by Mary McGregor, who was, I believe, from Minnesota. Very sweet. I'm sure you'd love it. Look it up. We did sing along. Anyway, I mention Mary because the heart and soul of the new model were rather in the same sort of dilemma, torn between two lovers. One suitor was the Cabinet of Grandees, as Lilburne scathingly called them, Fairfax, Ireton, Cromwell, St. John, Harry Vane. They offered unity. They offered a continued focus on making peace with the king, based around the Heads of Proposal, if the king could be forced to open his ears. On the other hand, the other suitor for the soul of the new model were the Radicals and the Levellers. The attraction of a world turned upside down, a new constitution of the power of the common people. This story was being played out against the background of continuing Presbyterian factions in the Commons. They were far from beaten yet and resolutely ignored the Heads of Proposal as a route to peace, pursuing the National Presbyterian Church and Covenant, formed up in the Newcastle Propositions. So really, you can see why Charles would follow a strategy of divide and rule. I mean, there is a lot of division going on. The House of Commons' continued refusal to fork out the necessary for the army was fed by public despair at all the taxation. And so the army was increasingly outraged. They called for the place to be purged of MPs. Radicals and Levellers played on this outrage. And the outrage was very deep. They kept coming back to the fact that they were no mercenary army, that they had shed their blood for the country and for its freedoms. Why were they being treated so badly like this? On the behalf of the grandees, then, Fairfax was trying to keep control of the army, continue with a parliamentary-based strategy, and keep the levellers at bay. He managed this and retained control by allowing the army agitators their head in the regular meetings of the General Army Council rather than trying to repress them. So in August, Fairfax agreed a remonstrance with the council and they sent it to the Commons, calling for an agreement on the basis of the heads. It was ignored. Fairfax moved his headquarters to Putney in September, in the west of London, and the meetings of the council continued. Sometimes in council, pretty hot words were now exchanged. Many soldiers were absolutely impatient of the lack of progress, and they demanded that they use force. At one meeting, Major Francis White, a convinced leveller, stood up in the council and demanded action. He condemned even the heads of proposal as a basis for agreement. He angrily thundered that Parliament was making deals with the Scots behind their back and that it should be purged. He declared that he saw no visible authority but the power and force of the sword. A treaty, he declared, must be imposed on Charles. Even talking to Charles was a betrayal of the revolution. Fairfax remained calm, firm, decisive. He expelled White from the council, had a vote on a statement that the army supported the authority and government of the kingdom as vested in the House of Commons, and there was not a single dissenting voice. Fairfax, Cromwell and Ireton, at bottom, always looked for a solution based on Parliament until the last moment, based on Parliament and the ancient constitution. However radical the heads of proposal might be, that was the basis for them. They only saw a peaceful future based on that and an agreement with the king. The levellers now increasingly thought differently. They wanted a completely new constitution and an end to this parliament. They were convinced Charles did not deserve to be any part of the discussion for any solution, and his role in the constitution should be severely restricted. The levellers were in the full flow now of a pamphleting war. In one of them, Richard Overton called on the nation to rise up against Parliament. He also developed his theory of law further, that legitimacy derives from common equity and right reason. The idea of natural, inalienable rights, independent even of the representative body of the Commons. William Wallin had organised petitions earlier in the year supported by the army grandees, but now a rift increasingly appeared between the levellers and the grandees and poisoned the relationship, and it centred around John Lilburne and his imprisonment in the Tower. Lilburne had been imprisoned for his vicious pamphlets attacking Manchester and the House of Lords. Fairfax and Cromwell had tried in August, tried to have him released, but the Lords point blank refused. Though actually, I have to say, Lilburne seemed to be able to leave Newgate Prison at will and wander around as he liked, but you know what? Early modern prisons are very odd institutions. Anyway, Wallin accused the grandees of the army now of deserting Overton and Lilburne and just leaving them in prison, which wasn't really very fair. Elizabeth Lilburne had been busy at army headquarters lobbying for John's release. On September the 15th, Cromwell took himself to Lilburne in prison and he tried to mend fences. "Come on," he urged his old friend. "Be reasonable. We are working on it." He tried to persuade John to stop his bitter hammering at Parliament. He promised that things would soon be resolved and righted if he could just be patient. Patience was not in honest John's vocabulary. So a couple of weeks later, he published an open letter to the soldiers of the army called "The Jugglers Discovered." It told the soldiers they must fight tooth and nail if the terms of their solemn engagement of June was to be fulfilled. The commons must be purged. Tithes and monopolies must be abolished. Free and equal justice must be provided. An end made to the free quartering of the army on the poor citizens. Now, all of these were part of a much stated leveller programme. But at the end, Lilburne now threw a new piece of invective into the stew and he warned, "Not to trust your great officers at the general's quarters no further than you can throw an ox, since they had most unjustly stolen power both from your honest general and your too flexible agitators." The wording of strategy is interesting. I mean, note how they don't use the name Fairfax, because you don't insult Fairfax in the army. But the levellers had come to the conclusion that the only agent of revolution that could bring the reforms they wanted was the army. They felt the soldiers' agitators had proved too mild, too susceptible to the leadership of the army. And therefore they started working hard now to build support in the military, independent of the command structure. They tried to persuade regiments now to appoint new agitators, their own agitators, not tied to the commanders of the army so closely. They had limited success at doing this, but they did have some success. Five regiments appear to have done so, appointing new agitators. And nonetheless, leveller influence was spreading. They urged soldiers to take control away from army command. The leveller John Wildman, the most revolutionary of them all, really, sounded pretty much Jacobin when he wrote that they should seize control from their officers. With a word, you can create new officers. Necessity has no law. Necessity has no law. Used and misused at many times and in many places for many reasons. Anyway, as far as ordinary soldiers were concerned, the levellers were talking a deal of sense. The refusal of Parliament to fulfil the solemn engagement to pay the army, the continuing parliamentary preference for a national Presbyterian church rather than toleration. But they did have two problems with the levellers' appeal. The first was that there was a fundamental mismatch between the interests of the two groups the levellers passionately claimed to represent, the common people and the army. The common people wanted rid of the army and the taxes that came with them. The army, on the other hand, could not live without the monthly assessment taxes and feared retribution if they were disbanded. A problem. The other issue was the respect the soldiers had for their senior officers, Fairfax and Cromwell in particular, and their passionate belief that unless they all stood together in unity across the army, rank and file and all the officers, they were doomed. Divide and they die. So the levellers were becoming more and more determined to split the rank and file from their commanders. Ireton, in particular, was their bête noire. They held him completely responsible for perverting Cromwell, and Cromwell, they felt, was now betraying their cause. But nobody could possibly attack Fairfax. Even more than Cromwell, he was revered. So the radicals had a really uphill battle, but they were pushing hard. They even began to find supporters in Parliament, just a small number of MPs, based, of course, around Henry Martin. And Henry Martin now introduced a bill into the Commons that they would love, a bill of no address. It demanded that no one talk anymore to the King. A constitution must be imposed on him. And Martin found quite a few supporters. One of them was Colonel Thomas Rainsborough, a man both radical and with a bit of a beef against Cromwell, who had tried to prevent his appointment as a vice-admiral in the Navy. In the Commons, Cromwell, Ireton, Vane, St John, Lilburn's cabinet of grandees all spoke against the vote of no address. And it failed. But by 84 votes to 34, it had gained support. Anger towards the King was growing. The radicals were gaining support. Given this growing movement, Cromwell and Ireton's reputation also suffered because of their determination that a lasting agreement must include Charles. They were constant visitors to Hampton Court. Charles had been flooded with visitors. He was loving it, which neither Fairfax nor Cromwell made any effort to stem, including, though it did, foreign diplomats, various Scottish commissioners. And Charles, in turn, wined and dined Cromwell and the grandees as well. On one famous occasion, Oliver and Elizabeth Cromwell, Henry and Bridget Ireton, Edward and Mary Whaley had all been royally entertained at the King's table. It wasn't a good look. The royalist press had a field day with rumours of all kind of stitch-ups. The more radical soldiers thought they were being way too deferential to the King. In fact, Cromwell and Ireton were loading the pressure on Charles. Towards the end of September, they threatened to withdraw the heads and proceed only on the basis of the Newcastle propositions. It produced a rather panicky letter from Charles to Parliament, confirming that the heads of proposal formed his preferred basis for discussion. But nonetheless, the pressure was behind the scenes. Outwardly, to the public, it didn't look good. There was far too much hobnobbing going on. Fairfax, meanwhile, seemed to be pretty immune to all the pressures from the agitators, radicals and levellers, but Cromwell felt it. He wrote to Michael Jones in Dublin of his upset at the accusations and that, "We doubt not but God will clear our integrity and innocence from any other ends we aim at, but his glory and the public good." Anyway, you get the picture, hopefully. Parliament, stubbornly trying to pursue the Presbyterian solution and defy an army dominated by independents. The levellers, seeking to divide the rank and file from their officers and bring them into a popular music for radical and democratic reform. Fairfax, Cromwell, Ireton, trying to hold it all together, trying to hold the unity and discipline of the army, moderate the radicals' demands, force the king to reasonable terms based on the heads of proposals. So, into this delicate situation on the 18th of October 1647 came a challenge that shook the army to the core and threatened to turn an increasingly politicised army into a revolutionary one. It came in the form of a paper addressed and presented to Thomas Fairfax. It was called "The Case of the Army, Truly Stated." It was signed by the five new leveller agitators of the army regiments and was probably written by two soldiers, mainly a 25-year-old leveller called John Wildman, son of a Norfolk yeoman, with the help of Edward Sexby, a grocer from Suffolk. The Case of the Army accused the army generals of treachery, of perverting the solemn engagement and the cause of reform. It advanced then a political agenda even more radical than those before it: universal manhood suffrage, liberty of conscience, codification of all English law, restating previous demands for abolition of tithes, a purge of Parliament, and fresh elections. Fairfax kept his cool, and in many ways his response, and indeed that of Cromwell, is quite remarkable. So this revolutionary paper was referred to the General Council of the Army to have a good talk through it, which is rather delightful. You can imagine the agenda. Item 1, new badges. Item 2, officer roll call. Item 3, universal manhood suffrage and a new constitution and legal system. Item 4, graffiti found on the walls of the officers' urinals. I mean, surely the normal army response would have been to extract the Wildman and Sexby guts, use them for garters, string up every other soldier found within 100 yards of them. But no, it was, OK, let's have a chat, talk it over. It is one of the aspects of the English Revolution I think is really important. At this stage in particular, what the levellers could not get by is that these were brothers in arms who respected each other irrespective of station in life or army command position. The truth is, the levellers would never quite manage to overcome that basic relationship. Anyway, the result would be that this petition would indeed be discussed at the army headquarters. There would be over 100 people there, because just to make sure the politics of this was ludicrously open, Cromwell even invited some civilian levellers along too. Just to make sure it wasn't dull and boring, Thomas Rainsborough also, even though he was in the Navy now. With over 100 people, it would take place in St Mary's Church in Putney. All welcome. Don't bring a bottle, because we're all Puritans. The Putney debates would open on the 28th of October, 1647. I do not know whether or not you have heard of them, but you jolly well ought to have done, because they are an honest attempt by a group of people to design a better political system. And we will hear about it next week. Before I go, though, I'd like to take you back to the sight of Thomas Fairfax in the coach in the army procession through London in August. I didn't want to break the narrative at the time, but just to pause a little here to talk about Anne Fairfax. Her presence in the coach next to her husband was really important, because tongues were wagging about the relationship between them. Anne Fairfax was strongly Presbyterian, so much so that Lucy Hutchinson would claim it drove a wedge between her and her husband Thomas. Though really, Thomas's precise religious affiliations are difficult to know, and he always stoutly defended Anne and their relationship. However, the point is that religion was the most common and acceptable way that women had in engaging with politics, although some people do go further, like Elizabeth Lilburn and Mary Overton. And we've already seen the engagement through religion with Catherine Chidley. So when Anne publicly promoted Presbyterian preachers while she was with the army, It was a kind of political statement, and she was constantly with the army, and particularly so after the siege of Oxford. At Nottingham in early 1647, Lucy Hutchinson wrote that she'd caused a stir by promoting the Presbyterian minister there. Again, that could be interpreted as a political statement, given the split between independents and Presbyterians. Anne continued to seek out Presbyterian ministers, as you would, of course, if that was your set of beliefs. So, given all these rumours and mutterings, her presence in the coach there was probably intended as a public display of unity by the Fairfaxes. Sadly, it may have had the opposite effect. Royalist writers were quick to mock the couple. They crowed that Lady Anne wore the trousers and was subverting the rightful patriarchal order. Independents in the army, meanwhile, worried that Anne would use her influence to sway Thomas from their cause. It's particularly significant here because Anne does indeed share many of the Presbyterian views, among which was an absolute opposition to putting the king on trial, which might possibly happen in the future, who knows. Anyway, that's just a wrinkle for you. So, back to it. Thank you everyone for listening so patiently. The story so far, King is talking to the Scots and holding out still from Parliament. The army are in a foment. The levellers are trying to create a rift between soldiers and generals and promote a radical democratic future and written constitution. Now they have their big opportunity at the next army council. Will they succeed? Well, I will see you next time in St Mary's Church on the banks of the River Thames in Putney. Until then, everyone, thank you so much for listening. Good luck, everyone, and have a great week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.